couple of years back, I was reading an account by a woman who'd been on a meditation retreat. You've probably heard about Vipassana romances. And she suddenly fixated on this young man who was also on the retreat. A very strong sense of desire. She found that she couldn't be in the hall with him, so she went off to meditate in her own room. And that's when she realized, she said, that it wasn't just her personal desire, it was cosmic desire running through her. And she wasn't responsible. And it's scary to think that this person is now a meditation teacher, teaching people that cosmic desire and whatever. And she'd missed an important point, that when these things come into the mind, it's not cosmic forces acting through you, it's your old karma. These thoughts that spring up over you and suddenly take you off in different directions. You're sitting here meditating, minding your own business, very dutifully working with the breath, and then suddenly you find yourself off someplace else. Well, the fact that there was the initial impulse to go someplace else, that's past karma. The present karma is your decision at some point to go along with it. But these things operate on such a below-the-radar level that we're hardly conscious of it. The fact that we did make a decision. And so this is one of the important issues you have to face in your meditation, that a lot of decisions are going on behind these walls you've erected in the mind, where you don't like to think about the decisions you're making. And so it's important as you meditate that you be prepared for the fact that the mind is going to leave the breath. There'll be a lot of vagrant intentions that don't fall in line with the initial intention, which was to stay here with the breathing, to try to stay concentrated all through the hour. And you've got to watch out both for the present karma of when you decide while you're meditating to suddenly slip off and contemplate what you're going to do next week or what you did last week or what you'd like to have for a meal tomorrow, or how you're upset about something somebody said or did, or how you're embarrassed about something you did a while back. These things are going to come up. And you've got to be prepared to notice the stirrings in the mind when they're just in an incipient form, so you can catch them in time and reaffirm your intention to stay here. With the breath, to enjoy the breath. So you're dealing with a complex issue. It's a combination of past karma and present karma. While you're here, you want to watch out for the past karma. While you're here, you want to watch out for the present karma. But then there's the question, where does that past karma come from? All too often when we think about the idea of past karma, we think about previous lifetimes, where you don't know who you were, or what you were doing, or why you're developing the habits you have. But often past karma is karma from today. Thoughts you had in the course of the day that you allowed yourself to wander with for a while. Well, that becomes a habit. And then that habit gets carried into the meditation. So when you're working on the mind, it's not just a matter of what you're doing while you're here, sitting with your eyes closed, but what you do and think about in the rest of the day. The Buddha talks about anusaya, which sometimes translated as latent tendency, sometimes as obsession. These latent desires, latent drives in the mind that we keep feeding. Throw them little scraps in the course of the day, and so they get used to wanting to feed. It's like a team of attack dogs that we keep penned up in the house. You don't want them to be too well fed, because then they get lazy and fat and they won't attack when you want them to. But they stay hungry. So you're constantly throwing the little scraps, because if you don't, they're going to turn on you and eat you. The thing is, of course, they're eating you all the time. But if you don't want them to attack to during the meditation, you have to learn how not to feed them at all, not keep them there in the house. There are 7 in all. I couldn't think of all 7 this afternoon, so I looked them up. And the list is this: sensual passion, irritation, views, uncertainty, conceit, passion for becoming, and ignorance. And these are the things that we keep feeding over the course of the day. You find yourself looking at something really attractive or listening to something really attractive. You're throwing a little scrap to sensual passion. Thinking about things that you feel righteously angry about, you're throwing some scraps to irritation and to views. And we do the same with ignorance, conceit, comparing yourself with somebody else to feel that, oh, I'm okay as a person. It's amazing how in the course of the day we compare ourselves to this person and that person, always finding somebody who's at least a little bit worse off than we are. So we can comfort ourselves with the idea that we're okay. Or you can focus on people who are way better than you are and get yourself down in the dumps. You have to ask yourself why the mind does that, what sort of satisfaction it finds there. Say, well, I can't be expected to do such and such because I'm just nowhere near where that other person was. That fulfills a nefarious role in your attitude towards the meditation. Passion for becoming, the desire to think about this little world of thought and that little world of thought. We keep these either for purposes of using them against other people or for our own entertainment, these attack dogs. Because part of us feels that if we didn't have sensual passion, didn't have greed, say, we wouldn't have the impulse to survive, the ability to survive. If we didn't keep our sense of righteous anger going one way or another, we wouldn't be able to fend off injustice. And one of the lessons the Buddha taught is that you don't need to have these defilements in order to survive. You don't need to have them in order to work for what's right. And there's certainly no help in training the mind. Some of them you have to use a little bit. He talks about passages where he talks about using conceit to help in the meditation. Or your passion for becoming, you create good states of concentration. Or irritation with your unskillful mental thoughts. So they do have some role, but you've got to watch out for the totally unskillful roles you give to these attack dogs. Because as I said, if you keep feeding them, they're going to expect to be fed all the time. And when they find they can't get fed in your meditation, they attack. And part of you pretends that you haven't been doing anything, you don't know where they came from, these are cosmic forces over which you have no control. But you have been feeding them in the course of the day. You've got to watch out for that. This is what restraint of the senses is all about. Instead of being Snow White living with 7 dwarfs, you're living with 7 attack dogs that you keep feeding. So as you look and listen and think in the course of the day, ask yourself, is this really helping in the practice, or am I feeding these attack dogs? This is why years back when Ajahn Sawat was asked about how to bring meditation into the course of your daily life, he focused on the issue of precepts and virtue. Sila is the Pali word. And ordinarily, when we think about precepts, we think primarily about the 5 precepts. And that's one level of restraint, which is important for reining in some of these attack dogs. But it goes on, other levels as well. Restraint of the senses is a kind of sila, as is purity of livelihood, a kind of sila. And the reflection on the requisites is a kind of sila, that before you use food, clothing, shelter, and medicine, you ask yourself, why am I using so much? Is it really necessary for the purpose of the practice? And as the Buddha realized as he was leaving his period of austerity, is that you do need to feed the body and treat it well enough so it has the strength to give rise to good states of concentration. But you have to be careful not to overindulge, because otherwise the anusaya, this obsession with sensual passion, gets fed and gets used to wanting more food. So these are two important practices. We do the reflection on the requisites after, as a group, at the end of the day here. But it's important to keep that reflection in mind as you go through the day. That combined with restraint of the senses and your general observance of the precepts is what helps keep these attack dogs in line. And it forms the past karma that will then be useful past karma when you're sitting here meditating. If you haven't been feeding the dogs all day, and you've been alert to noticing when you're feeding them, then you'll be more alert to them as you sit here and meditate. And that way they won't suddenly take over your meditation and devour it. So this isn't all-day, all-life practice. Many of us start out thinking, well, it'd be good to have some stress reduction, or good to meditate in order to calm the mind down a little bit. But as you find, the calm mind, the peace that comes with meditation is the only true form of happiness. Nati santi barang sukhang, as the Buddha said, there is no happiness other than peace. And the more you appreciate that, the more you realize what a full-time job it is to keep the mind peaceful. Especially in modern society where there's so many demands on our time. And the media use so many tricks for feeding our attack dogs, because they want to use our attack dogs to make money off of us. You got to watch out for that. At the same time, there's the general sort of modern tendency to want to simplify everything. Meditation is just stress release, or awakening is just getting the mind really still. There's that story of the woman who had the stroke who talks about her, quote, awakening, unquote. And everybody likes to believe that's all it is. Just cut off the left side of your brain and it'll be okay. But the practice has lots of ins and outs, because past and present karma interact in lots of complex ways. And it requires that we give as full attention to this process of finding true happiness for the mind as we can. And after all, it is your true happiness. It's not like you're being sucked into some brainless cult. You're being asked to take your true happiness seriously, which you think people would do naturally. And they should naturally, but they don't. The culture mitigates against it, and a lot of our own internal dishonesty mitigates against it. So it's going to take a while. It's a complex process to undo these tendencies, to undo these habits, these obsessions that we've developed. It's a full day, full lifetime process, but it's worth it. Because you ask yourself, if you're not giving yourself over to true happiness, what are you giving yourself to? You're just becoming food for your attack dogs. And if you don't learn how to stop feeding them, they'll just keep feeding on you again and again and again, all day long, all lifelong. But you have to ask yourself, do you want to be subject to this all the time, or would you like to be free? Because when you're free, you're not the only one who benefits. There's an interesting passage in the canon where Mahakasapa is talking to Ananda, saying that as a monk, his first 7 days, he ate the alms food of the country as a debtor. And then on the eighth day, when he gained full awakening, from that point on, he was no longer a debtor. And that's because as an arahant, he was had a wholly, totally different relationship to food. When he was eating food, it wasn't his attack dogs eating. He was simply eating out of the knowledge that he was going to stay alive long enough to live out his time. And he was feeding to keep the body alive and useful during that time. Standard phrase in the Tarakatha is, the arahants say, I don't delight in living, don't delight in dying. I live out my time, waiting my time, as a worker waiting for his wage. So the arahants eat without obsession. And in doing so, they, as they use the requisites, the people who provide the requisites gain a huge amount of merit. In fact, that's supposed to be one of the motivations we have for the practice, is that those who support us will gain a great reward, so that in your consumption of things, it's actually a gift. That's an amazing thing. For most of us, consumption is just consuming, then it's gone. Taking, taking, taking. We try to give back something. But the arahant, just the fact that the arahants are so pure, means that as you provide them with the requisites, anyone who's in any way involved in providing the requisites will gain huge rewards. So their consumption is actually an act of generosity. It's an act of giving. It's a very special way of living. So instead of attack dogs eating, it's all giving, giving, giving. There's a comment that John Swett made one time when someone said that this Buddhism you guys teach would be really good if you had a god to give you a sense of comfort and support as you go through difficult parts of the practice. And John Swat's response was, if there were a god who could decree that by my eating everybody else would become full, I would bow down and worship that god. Well, awakening does that to some extent. The arahants, when they consume their giving, and if that's not miraculous, I don't know what is.